Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's edition, we explore the fascinating stories behind Louisiana's rich baking culture. UNO history professor Michael Mizell Nelson and food historian Dana Logsdon give us a slice of the lost breads from lost bakeries that were once part of daily life. They also treat us to some sandwiches only your grandmother remembers eating. Then, third-generation John Gendusa talks about the role his grandfather played in creating the original poor boy loaf and why New Orleans French bread can be only made in New Orleans. There's the scent of yeast in the air on this week's Louisiana Eats. UNO history professor Michael Mizell Nelson has recently joined forces with Dana Logsdon, who formerly owned and operated La Spiga Bakery, to research the history and evolution of New Orleans French bread. They're joining us to share the fascinating things they've learned and reveal what has disappeared over time from our Louisiana baking landscape. Dana and Michael, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How many bakeries do you all estimate there actually might have been in New Orleans a century ago?
Well, it depends on the period. I mean, they're well over 100, sometimes the 120, 130, depending on the year you're looking at the city directories. But there were quite a few, and I think that has a lot to do with the taste memories of a lot of New Orleanians. Especially, I interview a lot of older people, and they'll say, oh, the po' boys today are okay, and the bread's changed, and then they'll start talking about their particular neighborhood and that particular bakery or corner grocery. And so there are things that are never going to come back about that taste sensation.
It is true. I think that just as many corner stores as we used to have, there used to be bakeries in every neighborhood, and everybody had their favorite bakery that they went to. And a lot of my research has been into the Italian bakeries. We all remember United Bakery, which closed after the floods of Katrina, but there were a lot of other bakeries. He descended, Sal Logidis, from a long line of Italian bakers, the Ruffino family, and you can still see a lot of the remnants of these bakeries if you walk around the French Quarter. You'll see the signs on the buildings, or you'll see the tiles on the sidewalk, but the bakeries themselves have virtually disappeared in terms of the Italian bakeries.
Why did that happen? Why do you suppose? Is it entirely the fault of the supermarket?
That's a very, very complex question, and I know that Michael probably has a lot of historical data about that, but it is something that when you talk to people, everybody reminisces about the different types of breads, and I've learned so much about breads that we no longer have anymore that were so common during the early 1900s and then into the 50s even, and even the 1980s, I think that our bread has changed a lot. I know wrapping of bread changed bread, I think, tremendously. And I think that wrapping bread also got people used to buying store-bought bread as opposed to buying their bread on a daily basis. A lot of the research that we've been doing has shown that bakeries would produce bread two or three times a day. It would come out of the oven hot, sometimes even four times a day. But they would deliver bread to your door. You could get bread delivered in the morning and the evening. So for each meal, you would have covered with fresh bread, which is something
incredible.
I hope somebody brings back.
Tell me how New Orleans French bread has changed, because, I mean, I know there's a difference when you get it wrapped in the plastic and it's soft and you got to stick it in the oven and do it yourself. But to me, I only remember it that one way that it is, with the soft inside and the hard, crunchy outside. But obviously, there was other stuff.
When we were preparing for a panel we did at the Poor Boy Festival, we were talking to one of the new bakers who's moved into the Carrollton area, Breads on Oak Street. And Michael has done some research about a bakery that was on the same location 100 years ago called Charles Bowl Bakery.
Did they go there because they knew it was a baking spot, or was that just a coincidence?
It was just a coincidence. I'm not sure if it's the exact spot. It's the same intersection.
And we're going with it, though.
Well, it's close enough. Their mule car barn was for deliveries. They had their carriage to deliver to the farm area in Jefferson Parish and deeper into Carrollton where some of the dairies were located. Right. But yeah, they just happened to land there, and it's just a coincidence.
Right. And one of their specialties was something called frog loaves, which we can get back to later since we're trying to talk about French bread. But in looking for more information about frog loaves, I started coming across more and more ads for New Orleans French bread. And when I talked to some of the people also that are maybe in their 70s in New Orleans, they would start talking about what they call the long loaf, which I always just, you know, French bread for me was always the French bread that you buy now in the store. But apparently French bread used to be a little bit more what you would call kind of like a French batard, where it was a little fatter in the middle. It had a large slit or a crease down the middle. And then the ends were a little bit pointed and knobbed, so almost like twisted. And there are a lot of memories of people, you know, breaking it open, scooping out the insides, putting in things like molasses and butter, or if you're Italian, it would have been lemon ice or red beans and rice and, you know, different things that they would stuff them with. And those are sort of the memories that people have of eating the bread. But in terms of the actual bread itself, I don't remember it either, but it appears to have been slightly denser from what people describe it, not quite as light and airy as present French bread. Right.
So what other kind of specialty sandwich breads did you uncover?
Most people seem to make sandwiches on little rolls. That is what we discovered a frog loaf was a small roll that was sort of like a crusty little French roll. And there were a lot of articles in the Times-Picayune about, you know, whether it was ham sandwiches on frog rolls or hot dogs or that kind of thing. And then the other types of breads that we discovered, and a lot of these were reflections of whatever immigrant group was baking, but there were a lot of whole grain breads, which is something that you don't see traditional New Orleans bread bakers doing anymore. So whole wheat, or they called it graham bread, a lot of rye bread, which is virtually impossible to find now in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things that we found is that there was a Master Bakers Association, which was founded in 1892, and they started a campaign right about the time that the poor boy loaf would have been born. And I don't know that they were sensing perhaps a little bit of competition, but they started a whole campaign to save New Orleans French bread. And they decided that they were going to band together as a group and promote themselves as quality French bread bakers. They created a seal, a logo, and they had a series of ads that are quite interesting and hilarious. They had a radio program with the French bread doughboys.
Because this was sort of an anti-poor boy reaction?
I wouldn't necessarily. That's a theory you could project.
Yeah, we're still, but I would think it could not be coincidence that this happens as the sandwich loaf and the long loaf.
Right, because you would see ads that would differentiate bakeries would have French bread and they would have poor boy loaves.
Okay.
Whereas today we have interchanged it and use French bread to mean poor boy loaves because the old type French bread has virtually disappeared. But going back to this ad campaign, they promoted it as healthy, that your children, if I can read one,
sure,
which my son would love because he's an absolute bread fanatic, sturdy young bodies skimming through the sunlight, health running a ruddy course through their cheeks, the golden days of childhood. Mothers, guard the health of your children with French bread. It provides the wholesome nourishment they need. And they have pictures of the old style French bread, and they have their logo. And then they encourage the different bakeries to use that logo in their ads that they would produce independently and also on their wrappers. And just by coincidence, I had no idea when I picked up Rouse's has started carrying Binder's French bread.
Yes.
And their wrapper still has the emblem on it.
So what do you see that's happening new in the world of baking here?
I'm, for one, being a baker, am very excited about some of the new bakeries and bakers that have sprung up recently. When I had my bakery, I felt as though there weren't many people baking things from scratch. There were the traditional bread bakeries, and those, I think, have dwindled even further. But there are some new bakeries that have opened up, Gracious, Breads on Oak, Tartine, Maple Street Patisserie, and I know I'm forgetting some, so please excuse me. But these are bakeries that are starting to produce bread and things made from scratch. So I'm excited to see that there's a movement to come back to revive some of these old traditions that we had 100 years ago.
The flip side of that, I guess, is something John Gendusa had mentioned a few years ago, that he was concerned. He was out in the suburbs and he had seen a bimbo bread delivery truck. It's the world's largest baker, and they're coming out of Mexico. And I think at the time they were making deliveries from Houston. There's now in the metro area, there's a distributorship. And this means that we're becoming ever more like other bread markets. And and so the first time he mentioned, I felt the same way. I'd never heard of it. Unfortunately, it's something that is a sign of the times. And so in the same way, people are becoming accustomed to Subways and Quiznos and now Jimmy John's, these things that are, you know, baking some bread-like substance on site.
Some bread-like substance.
But this is another element to it. And so now we're getting things baked. And we're all, you know, New Orleanians are now, we're accustomed to eating some king cakes that are shipped in from Texas. And, you know,
it's shocking. That should be against the law.
That should be.
It should be, but, you know, that's many
we
of us
also shouldn't be eating them year-round. But
right, we
that's
shouldn't
another
be eating,
subject.
Yeah. That's a whole nother. I really don't want to see another Saints king cake as far. I don't care if they go to the Super Bowl or not. I don't want to see cake associated with it. Thank you all so much for sharing this wealth of historical knowledge with us. Please keep up the good work.
We will. And go out and buy some New Orleans French bread.
UNO history professor Michael Mizell Nelson and professional baker Dana Logsdon. When we come back from a short break, third generation John Gendusa shares the story of the role his grandfather played in creating the original poor boy loaf. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero was born into a famous New Orleans restaurant family, but has chosen a different path in life.
Around the turn of the century, around 1900, you have a lot of compendium cookbooks come out. You have the Boston Cooking School cookbook. So the Picayune Creole cookbook, it's first released in 1900. Commonly thought that the first edition is 1901. That's just a mistake that's been perpetuated for decades and decades. So, for instance, between that first edition in 1900 and the fourth edition in 1910, credit is given to both African-American cooks and white cooks. Now, that changes when credit is given to professional white male chefs from France, from other parts of Europe.
While doing research on the topic as he studied for his PhD, our hero revealed with substantiation who exactly wrote one of New Orleans' first cookbooks.
Her name was Mary Louise Poin. She was a French Creole, grew up in an elite household in the Garden District. And she also wrote for Catholic magazines and publications. She was a hearty Catholic.
Give our heritage hero a topic, and he really goes to town. Most recently, he formulated a fascinating theory about the myth of the praliniere, the classic New Orleans 19th century praline seller.
They always portray the praliniere, the African-American woman selling pralines on the streets of antebellum New Orleans. However, looking at accounts from the 19th century, there's nothing. There's no accounts of women selling pralines out of baskets before the Civil War. It's really after the Civil War that women and men are able to have a business, to express themselves on the streets of New Orleans by cooking and selling food.
These are just a few of the reasons that this week's Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, is Ryan Fertel, grandson of Ruth Fertel, founder of the Ruth's Chris Steakhouse Empire. If you'd like to learn more about Ryan's work, pick up a copy of Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine, where you can read an article that explores his religious heritage with local Jewish food maven Mildred Covert. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. New Orleans, our food culture celebrates French culinary tradition with every bite of pomme souffle and trout meunière. But don't try to discuss New Orleans French bread with a Frenchman. No, no, they will protest. This is not French bread. No one will argue that the long loaves of crispy goodness with the shattering brown crust revealing soft, tender, white, chewy insides bear only a passing resemblance to a Parisian baguette. Here to explain to us where our baking traditions changed course from our French roots is third-generation baker John Gendusa, owner of the John Gendusa Bakery, where the New Orleans poor boy loaf originated. John, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Nice to be here.
So tell us, what makes New Orleans French bread so different and special?
Well, there are several things. I think one is the water. It definitely has a big effect on the taste of the bread and the outcome of the bread also being light and fluffy. And what happens is we call it French bread, but my father was from Italy. We have other bakers from Germany and all over. We don't have any real Frenchmen in New Orleans who make French bread. So it's a different and unique type of bread only found in New Orleans from the various people that have made it and come together and gotten this loaf together. But it's very airy. When you put meat, whatever you seafood on it, you can taste what you put on it instead of just having a lot of heavy, heavy doughy bread on it. And it's very nice for a sandwich.
I'll say. Your grandfather, the first John Gendusa, actually helped Benny and Clovis Martin develop that first poor boy loaf. Tell us how that came about.
They were having problems. The real French bread is fat in the middle and pointed on the ends. And if you got the skinny end of the sandwich, you didn't get too much of a sandwich. So he was getting complaints. Some people were getting big sandwiches, and some were getting the skinny ends of the sandwich. When my grandfather was a child back in Sicily, he used to stay around the bakeries there. That's why he wanted to become a baker. And he remembered they made the long, straight loaves of bread there. So he made some for the Martins, and they decided they were going to try it, and it worked out great.
I've heard a lot of suppositions about why New Orleans French bread can be only made in New Orleans. What is your theory?
Actually, I don't think anyone knows for sure, but some of the theories are, and the biggest one being the water, the New Orleans water. This is one of the biggest factors I consider to be. Also, the fact that a lot of the bakeries have been in the buildings that they've been in for so many years, and the yeast builds itself up in the building, and you get this flavor from the yeast. When I left my old bakery, came to the new bakery, I took some old dough with me and just put it all around the bakery so I could get the yeast back into the building again. One of the things that happened, I wasn't around, my father told me about this. He had two top-notch bakers, They left, went to Baton Rouge, and they were going to make French bread, New Orleans French bread. Never could do it. They tried and tried. They came back, talked to my father. They tried things, and they never could find out what was wrong and how to make a loaf of bread in Baton Rouge.
And these were your dad's master bakers.
Absolutely. They were top-notch bakers.
So they were replicating the equipment, the ingredients?
Everything, everything. They would talk with my father. My father would try to help them out. And everything they did, nothing came to pass to make a good loaf of poor boy bread in Baton Rouge.
New Orleans French bread bakers are a bit of a vanishing breed. We lost several bakeries after Hurricane Katrina, but luckily you rebuilt and reopened your Gentilly Bakery. What's the future of the John Gendusa Bakery?
Future is my son. My son is in it. He's been in for 10 years now, and he's just about getting ready to learn how to make a loaf of French bread after those 10 years. Daddy's still got to show him a few things, but he's really getting down to the point where he can make a very good loaf of bread.
Our listeners might be wondering why they never see a loaf of John Gendusa French bread in a grocery store. Tell us about the focus of your business.
Mainly, we go to the restaurants and hotels in New Orleans, and we're kind of behind the scenes. You won't see us out in front with wrappers and advertising, anything like that. It's all hotels and restaurants.
And with your Italian heritage, you do a little bit of the muffaletta loaf, too, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, the muffaletta is starting to come up. We're selling more and more muffalettas as the years go by lately, since the storm, actually.
I've got one more question for you. You told me that you have had some very interesting people work for the John Gendusa Bakery before. Do you want to tell us anybody important that has worked for you?
We had a fellow by the name of Kermit Ruffin work for us. He was a bread driver for me, and he and a friend of his left New Orleans, and they went to Atlanta, and he was blowing his horn there, and he had some business to take up there, and they stayed there quite a few years. In fact, I saw Kermit right after the storm, and we talked about the old times, how he'd miss a day's work because he blew his horn too late in the morning and couldn't make it in to work.
Well, you are such a precious piece of New Orleans food history. I'm thrilled that you could come in and talk to us today. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Gendusa III of the John Gendusa Bakery, where the New Orleans poor boy loaf was born and where the family baking tradition is still alive and well.
But first we'll make a stop on Payson Street by the Vucare. There's nothing like a party down in the old Tremmen. It's 3 in the morning and the joint just started jumping. And now you're looking good, so let's party till the sun come up. Yeah, now.
Back in the early 70s, when I first began cooking as a child, convenience foods were all the rage in America's home kitchens. Recipes that incorporated boxed mixes spread like wildfire at coffee clutches and women's clubs as those newly liberated women tried to save time, while they also did it all. I harbor some special nostalgia for the Lemongello pound cake I learned to make back then. It's a simple preparation that combines yellow cake mix, Lemongello, eggs, vegetable oil, and water. The cake is baked in a bundt pan, then finished with a glaze made with lemon juice and powdered sugar. When I was about 12 years old, I baked this cake for Mother's Day. Much to my distress, when dessert was served, the cake had a terrible fishy taste. That's when I discovered that my mother saved and reused oil that had been previously used for frying fish, something I don't believe in today, and how the fishy taste got in there. Every time you reuse vegetable oil for frying, the quality degenerates a bit, causing your fried food to taste greasier and greasier. I think life is too short to reuse oil, so if you want to extend the life of your oil, it makes far more sense to find someone who transforms used oil into biodiesel, a process that is taking place today in some folks' backyards. In any case, I'll never forget that Mother's Day and the reaction of my sweet grandmother, Nana, who ate every bite of that nasty cake, saying, "Really, Poppy, it's good." To find a copy of this easy retro recipe, visit our website at wwno.org, because an old-fashioned lemon jello pound cake still makes for good Louisiana eats.
Oh, I don't know where you came from, 'cause I don't know where you've been, but it really doesn't matter. Grab a chair and fill your platter and dig, dig, dig right in. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked the cake, hired a band. Goodness sake, if I knew you were coming, I'd have baked the cake. Hat-cha-do, hat-cha-do, hat-cha-do. Hat-cha-do, hat-cha-do, hat-cha-do.
Although obsessed with baking since she was a little girl, pie became a passion for Seattle's Kate McDermott in 2005 when she began a 2-year exploration of pie crust. In 2010, Seattle Magazine named Kate Food Rock Star of the Year. Kate's mission is to make the world better, one pie at a time. We're turning to Kate for pie making advice. Kate, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you, Poppy. I'm just tickled to be here.
So tell me, what do you think the biggest secret to pie making really is?
There's nothing that is hard about pie. In fact, those words, easy as pie, they really do have some truth in them. I think the biggest thing is just to believe that you can do it, not to worry about a perfect outcome, because in those little places where you have a little tear here in the crust, or you have a little, it didn't look quite like the pictures in the book, you have beauty and perfection right there in that pie.
And good taste, too, I imagine.
And memories.
Well, start us off from scratch. How do you make a pie?
I'd love to tell you that. First thing I do is I want to make sure that all my ingredients are chilled, as many as possible. So I am putting my flour in the freezer. I'm keeping my fats well chilled. My bowl comes out of the freezer, too. Then I have a very, very simple recipe. It's got 4 ingredients for the dough. There's flour, 2.5 cups. There's salt, 1/2 teaspoon. There's the fats. I use leaf lard, 8 tablespoons of that, and 8 tablespoons of butter, and enough water to put it all together. Now, when I'm working with those fats and moving them into the flour, I'm working very, very quickly. I can do this either with my hands and just sort of smush that fat right into the flour until it looks like it's sort of coated with cracker crumbs, peas, almonds, and maybe a small walnut meat or pecan if you like that. Then I will get the water in until it's mixed enough to hold together without being sticky. And when I pull it into a ball that's about the softball size, you kind of feel, you know you're there if you can feel like you're going to pat a baby's bottom.
Well, tell me, what is leaf lard?
Leaf lard is the rendered fat from around the pig's kidneys. For generations, it is what pie makers have used for the flakiest crusts around.
Where do you get leaf lard from?
I have several places that I get it. I'm using so much leaf lard in my classes monthly. I go through 50 pounds of leaf lard in a month.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm teaching a lot. So I get it from a place in Pennsylvania, Dietrich's Meats and Country Store, and you'll love where they're in, Crumbsville, Pennsylvania.
Well, that's perfect for pie making. I'm going to have to do some research to find out where our listeners can find leaf lard. What do you do if the pie doesn't work out?
Uh-huh. That's happened to every pie maker around. First thing, you don't worry about it. And then you get out your lasagna pan and you turn that pie with its beautiful ingredients into the pan, move those pie ingredients around that's baked, and it turns into the best crumble you've ever had.
That's a perfect solution. What do you do if your guests are gluten-free?
Ah, yes. Gluten-free is a big thing now, and I myself try not to eat too much gluten, but for those who can't eat it at all, You can make a gluten-free pie that's pretty darn good. I use 7 different flours, and then I just go ahead and pretty much make my dough as usual. There's a couple little tricks to it. Instead of making my dough first and chilling it, and then making my filling and then rolling out, I put my filling together first, then immediately go on to making my gluten-free dough and construct the pie, and then chill it.
What are those flours?
I use several different rice flours. I use potato starch, tapioca flour, or tapioca starch. Those are just a few of the ones that I use in there.
Speaking of tapioca starch, this is something else that I really don't have any experience with. And you and I shopped for pie ingredients together, and I have to admit I was a little shocked when I saw the famous pie maker add a little red box of something that said instant on it really big to the shopping cart. What was that, Kate?
Well, that was a pie maker's best friend. That was quick cooking tapioca. When I have fillings, I call them the juicy fruit fillings. These would be rhubarb, pie cherries, berries, and frozen fruits. Those can get very, very wet inside of your pie. So I like to use quick cooking tapioca, which really sort of snugs things up. I don't want it standing up like a little soldier at the end, because I like to have a certain amount of ooze in my filling, but I don't want to have fruit soup. So I will put in many times some flour, a third of a cup, a quarter cup of flour, and then follow that with anywhere between a half a teaspoon to a tablespoon and a half of quick cooking tapioca. Now, there is another secret that you'll need to know when you're using quick cooking tapioca. And that is you have to get the temperature high enough for the tapioca to do its work. So if you don't see enough bubbling at the end of your bake time, and I'm not talking about rapid bubble, I'm talking about some steady, even bubbling, then you can go ahead and kick your oven up for the last 5 minutes, maybe to 425, maybe to 440, until you see that, and then you're good to go.
Some pies are sort of mounded, and some pies are flat. What's the deal with that?
There are two fruits that I will mound a pie with. That will be apple and pear, and those I just mound something fierce. It's not unusual for me to have a 6.5-inch tall apple pie or pear pie. They will slump down in the cooking, and their juice stays in pretty well if you've got enough thickener in there. But with those juicy fruit pies, I like to have them a little flatter. I would like to have them about 1/2 inch below the rim so we don't have any disasters.
Now, I have to ask you, what's your favorite pie?
Well, my favorite pie is always the one that I'm making. But if I had only one last pie to make, it would be a peach pie. I think that there's nothing finer than a good peach pie. And I love the Cal Red or O. Henry peaches that Frog Hollow Farms grows in California. There's nothing like those peaches.
Well, someday I'm going to have to introduce you to a Louisiana Ruston peach. And then we might change your mind just
I'm ready. Anytime.
Do you have a least favorite?
Yes.
What's that?
I call it the clean the oven pie. That's the one that I think we've all had experience with at some time or the other, where you put that filling up too high in the pie and it spills over into your oven. And then you have the smoke alarm going off and the oven is just, you don't want one of those. We've all had them.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for bringing all this pie-making knowledge into the studio here at Louisiana Eats. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Poppy, and be happy and make pie.
Renowned pie baker, Kate McDermott. After the next break, we're coming back with UNO history professor Michael Mizell Nelson, who divulges his latest personal research project, something that has begun to border on an obsession, a colorful, rum-soaked delicacy called Russian cake. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. University of New Orleans history professor Michael Mizell Nelson has shared his boundless knowledge of New Orleans streetcar traditions and his efforts to help save the iconic poor boy sandwich. Michael's latest obsession is the Russian cake, a classic New Orleans bakery tradition that is currently verging on extinction. Michael, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
So, for listeners who may never have heard or tasted this, could you give us the full description?
Okay, first, I'd say think of bread pudding and how that doesn't necessarily look very appetizing, but it tastes good. And think in terms of a dessert that sort of developed in the same way. And it's to make use of all things left over. So it was often stale cake scraps originally, though today's bakeries in New Orleans tend to emphasize that these aren't stale parts. They purposely pull together their best ingredients. So it's a combination of usually yellow cake, wedding cake, often chocolate cake, and sometimes a bit of food coloring. And so it ends up being a red, technicolor, kind of messy-looking cake, bound together with jelly, sometimes strawberry, sometimes raspberry jelly. And they're usually served in little rectangular slabs. Mm-hmm. You'll find it at Dorniak's or Binder's. We'll have slightly larger slabs of cake.
And it's iced with a white icing of some
sort. Right,
there's
a white icing with decorative balls on top.
Usually lots of garish sprinkles,
yes,
I recall.
Right, the sprinkles. And once you're served the cake, there's an aroma of the rum. It's a big part of Russian cake, and I think that's why it kind of succeeds. Or rum extract. There are some bakeries that don't use rum itself anymore, but the rum aroma, as a child, that was one of my first encounters. The odor of the alcohol and then the warning from my parents that, you know, don't eat too much. It's very rich, and there's alcohol in it.
The same cake is actually known by slightly different names in Baton Rouge and Lafayette.
Well, and also other parts of the world. Russian slab cake is how it's advertised at times in Lafayette and Baton Rouge. The term gets used a lot to describe many different types of cake, but the way we know it in Louisiana, that doesn't seem to appear too many other places except in a section of North England. I found that really fascinating. That's what I hope to find out more about.
North England? What does this have to do with Russian cake?
Well, I was looking at a posting on a food blog, and I've long been interested in Russian cake, and I'd seen somebody had baked it, and it was a beautiful photograph of what he had done, and all the people from the post-Katrina diaspora, all these New Orleanians, were mentioning that, you know, we can't find Russian cake anywhere around here. They mentioned they're in California, Virginia, and I thought that was interesting, but then I started seeing postings from North England say, yes, I can't find this anymore. Does anyone know where we can get this? And they tended to use the term Russian slab cake. That, to me, is really fascinating. I hope to find out a little bit more about how it came to occupy a very small part of England.
Yes, you're really going to have to research that, because I can't say that I have ever heard anybody give me a number or any culinary connections between North England and South Louisiana. This is really a stretch here, Michael.
I know, and I'm fascinated. One of the links that I followed was actually a woman. She said she wanted to recreate her Christmas memories. There's this holiday connection to Russian cake. There are some bakeries that would only make it during the holiday season. of course, one of the great keepers of the Russian cake flame is the Heidel family, and was able to talk to Dottie Heidel, and she mentioned that a certain New Year's Eve party she goes to every year, her friend insists that she bring a Russian cake.
But thank goodness the Heidels don't just restrict it to holiday time only. You can get Russian cake there almost any time if you've got the yen, right?
Right, and you can order it around the world. In fact, I was amazed to learn that there's a man in Paris or somewhere outside of Paris who actually orders it once a year for Bastille Day. Yes, a Heidel's Russian cake to celebrate Bastille Day.
Well, I know that this is a very treasured childhood memory of yours. Tell us about your childhood memories of Russian cake and what it means to you personally.
It was this amazing sensation. I mean, you can smell a Russian cake when they open the box. And, you know, now our son Arlo is great. He loves Russian cake, and he also tends to love one particular bakery's version of Russian cake. So I've passed on the tradition.
That's really good. That's just what we like to hear on Louisiana Eats. Well, I really want to thank you for sharing this delicious mystery story with us. And I personally would like to give you the wish that I hope you can always have your Russian cake and eat it, too.
Oh, thank you.
UNO history professor Michael Mizell Nelson and the case of the disappearing Russian cake. Public radio contributor and author of Louisiana Rambles, Ian McNulty is always hunting down a new obscure but delicious spot for rambling. So, Ian, where are we rambling to today?
Oh, hey, Poppy. Today we're heading out to Eunice, which is that farm town and hub of Acadian culture out there high on the Cajun Prairie north of Lafayette. One of the big draws here is the Liberty Center, which hosts its weekly show called Rendezvous to Cajuns.
Yeah. And what happens at that show?
Yeah. So this is a long-running live show. It's broadcast on local TV and radio. It has musical guests, some bilingual English-French commentary from the evening's host. The format is sort of like Grand Ole Opry or Louisiana Hayride or even like the Cajun version of the Prairie Home Companion, if you can imagine that. So they do it at the Liberty Center, which is this historic theater from the 1920s. It's just this really cool building with this gleaming marquee, and it's right in downtown Eunice. And you could, it's really easy to imagine this being a real focal point for life out on the prairie in the old days.
Absolutely.
You're probably wondering, where the food part of this is coming
in.
Well, here it comes. So this weekly Rendezvous to Cajun show, people line up. There's lots of families in the audience. And this being Cajun country, people are really eager to waltz and do the two-step around the floor. And as we well know, Cajun dancing is really hungry work.
It is.
So after these shows, which wrap up early in the evening around 7:30 on Saturdays, people start looking for dinner. And these days, that leads many of them just two blocks up the street, up 2nd Street, which is sort of the main drag in downtown Eunice, to a place called Ruby's Restaurant and Courtyard.
Really?
Yeah, this is a new place. It's a family-style Cajun restaurant. You kind of know the format already. It's the kind of place where people leave with leftovers usually. Nobody really leaves less than stuffed. It's the kind of place where you get appetizers that the whole table has to split. There's some steaks, overstuffed po'boys, platters of seafood, and the kitchen just uses etouffee like it's a sauce and cheese by the fistful. We'll talk about how they do that in a second. The restaurant itself used to be called Nick's on 2nd. So travelers around the area will probably remember Nick's. It was initially a bar. And in addition to the normal distractions of the bar, people would gather here to play dominoes or bourre, the Cajun card
course.
Game. Yeah. But today, that bar and some collection of old photos around the place are sort of the links of the past for this restaurant, which is really quite modern. The courtyard that referenced in Ruby's name there is sort of a mid-size event space. But most of the dining goes on in the main dining room, sort of this long, narrow room. There's no windows back there, but it doesn't really matter because everyone's focused on what's on the plate. So what's on the plate, right?
Yeah, what's on that plate?
We're starting off with gumbos, of course, seafood, chicken and sausage. But then also the seafood chowder that I found pretty interesting.
Chowder? That's really unusual for Louisiana.
Right. You don't usually see chowder on the prairie. But this was, you know, milky, thick chowder with oysters and shrimp and corn in there. Kind of an interesting option. You probably won't be surprised to find a fried gator and catfish on the list like this. Although I was a little surprised to find charbroiled oysters and barbecue shrimp. It's sort of a little more New Orleans style than we find on the prairie.
Amazing how that food's traveling these days.
It certainly is. But the appetizer actually that really stood out for me was something called almond shrimp. Kind of a sweet, spicy, Asian-style glazed fried shrimp over this platter of slaw that's all strewn with slivered almonds. Sort of an Asian-Cajun thing going on.
That's so cool.
Yeah, a little different from your typical mom-and-pop Cajun place. You know, you can get fried shrimp platters, catfish platters, a couple pastas, that sort of thing. But what I really like here are these specialties, that great contemporary Cajun zeal for mixing various Sioux foods and capping it all off with cheese and rich sauces. You know what I'm talking
about.
Oh, yeah.
I know what you're talking about. And you are making me so hungry.
Well, these things arrive, and you need to be hungry. These are huge portions, of course. We're talking about seafood enchiladas, seafood crepes. Both of these things emit this blend of shrimp and sweet crab all bound up with this creamy goodness. I mean, it's really like a seafood dip that comes pouring out of these things.
It sounds like this is a whole new version of Cajun fusion.
Yeah. It almost sounds too much when you think about it. Like all this cheese and sauce on this seafood, you know, sometimes the best way to do seafood is not to do very much with it at all.
Yeah.
But it comes off really good here. That one of my favorites is the seafood dot. Fried shrimp curled over this casserole dish of molten, bubbling shrimp and crab au gratin.
Well, it sounds like this menu goes on for pages and pages.
Yeah, it's pretty extensive. So this is not exactly delicate cuisine, but, you know, the Ruby's menu sits at that intersection of, like, abundant seafood that we have here and that sort of exuberant approach to dressing it up for hungry diners. And so if you're, you know, heading out to Eunice and you're hungry, whether you've been dancing up a storm or just burning up some miles on the road, this is a place that's going to take care of you in a good Cajun way.
So how are the prices?
This is a mid-range restaurant, definitely family-friendly. It's a nicer place. It's not really like a grab-and-go kind of takeout. You know, this is very familiar, kind of family-friendly
stuff.
Well,
good for them up there in Eunice. Yep. Thank you so much for taking us on another delicious trip.
Yeah, that was Ruby's Restaurant and Courtyard. You can find them on the internet there, but they're on 2nd Street right in downtown Eunice.
Thank you, Ian.
My pleasure.
Louisiana Eats rambling reporter Ian McNulty. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we have a rollicking visit with CBS soap opera star Christian LeBlanc.
When you say I'm going to New Orleans, it's not like I have to twist anybody's arms. And I've had people from Days of Our Life, from all different shows that have come down with me. And to do, I mean, God bless, they will come up and go into the swamps with me to raise money. New Orleans kind of soaks up a lot of the charity work here. It's such a, you know, and well-deserved and well-needed. But there's so much need out in the parishes, the rural parishes in particular, that those are my people. You know, I'm a LeBlanc. All those LeBlancs that owe you money, those are my people.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lights Egan and Westside Lights Egan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.